There are more than 18,000 volunteer firefighters in the state of Iowa. Your life may depend on one of them. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The new documentary, Iowa's Firefighting Family, profiles the Butlers of Harlan, Iowa, seven volunteer firefighters in one family. This hour, we'll meet Tom and Chad Butler.
There's no greater honor than to give your life for another. So if that's what I'm asked to do, then that's what I'll do. It's not about having the time to do it. It's about making the time to do it.
We'll also talk with other volunteer firefighters and emergency medical technicians from around the state. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When the call comes, firefighters respond. It could be a false alarm or small grass fire, but it could also be a situation where lives are being threatened, a car accident or a house fire. There are more than 18,000 volunteer firefighters in Iowa, men and women who will risk their lives to save yours. A new documentary, Iowa's Firefighting Family, airs tonight at 7 p.m. on Iowa Public Television. It profiles the Butler family of Harlan, Iowa. Seven members of the family are volunteer firefighters. In a few minutes, we'll meet two members of that family. But first, Jacob Rosdale is the producer of the documentary. Hello, Jacob.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And we have so many volunteer firefighters in Iowa, more than I ever knew. What got you interested in profiling volunteer firefighters?
The idea actually had come from Iowa Public Television to do a story on multi-generational family of firefighters. But once I started researching it, it was just extraordinary how much these men and women give of their daily lives to help others. And doing it through a family was very interesting to me because as we talked to more and more firefighters, we realized that word kept coming up, family. And in fact, Iowa's firefighting family isn't just the Butlers. It's everyone who is a firefighter in the state of Iowa.
Well, you mentioned that word family, and we often hear people talk about, you know, the people I work with are like my family. Do you think, though, that is particularly true when you talk about a group of firefighters, people who are working side by side and at tremendous risk?
Yeah, for sure. I think it comes a lot to trust. These people who fight fires together, they probably trust each other more than I probably even trust my own family. It's literally their lives are on the line, so there needs to be this bond between them. And it comes, you know, when they're out on a scene or just hanging out with each other, they give each other a hard time. They jab at each other. It's a very interesting dynamic that I hope our film captures at least a little bit of.
Well, I want to play just a moment of audio from your film.
It's in my family.
It's in my family.
It's a family kind of ordeal.
I guess it just kind of ran in the family.
My brother was on. Dad's been in it for 30 years.
I'm fourth generation on Center Point Fire Department.
So my brother's on the fire department. My mom and dad are both on the fire department.
But my grandfather, my father, my uncle, and two cousins before me.
My dad was a volunteer firefighter. My husband is a volunteer firefighter.
Me and one of my mentors were in a building that was getting weak. And due to my father standing outside and his past and his experiences, was able to see that the building structure was getting weak, and was able to get us out of there before the building did end up collapsing.
Those are the voices of volunteer firefighters from all over Iowa, and there seem to be a lot of family ties, real family ties, within these volunteer fire departments.
When we were looking for a family to the cover, we found out there were a lot of options out there. It seems to be something that gets passed down from generation to generation. And we really stumbled upon something special with the Butlers, who had, I think, seven members of their family in the department.
Which is truly remarkable, but clearly there are many families with three or four.
Yeah, it's
which
just
is remarkable.
It's a bonding
too.
Thing, I think, with people. I think they like to, it's something they like to share with the people they love, even though it's a dangerous, I don't know if I should use the word profession, because there, many of them are volunteers, but it is incredible.
How did you find the Butlers?
I had sent an email out to the Iowa Firefighters Association president, and they sent it to some board members, and the chief, Roger Beeson, recommended the Butlers in Harlan, which is in the western side of the state, for those who don't know. And we drove out there and met them, and they were just so welcoming to us, myself and my director of photography, Aaron Riggs, who we stayed in Harlan for a week, staying in the Butler's house. And they were so generous, and the fact that they had so many members and each of them had a different personality, we knew that was a great way to approach this documentary.
Well, and you mentioned where Harlan is for people who may not know. It's a very small town. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
It's just one of those nice Iowa small towns. They love their local football team, great town square. It was just a welcoming town, and we couldn't have done it without the help of the Harlan Fire Department and the city of Harlan in general being so welcoming to us.
Well, in just a few minutes, I'm going to talk with Tom Butler, who is the head of this firefighting family, Chad Butler as well, another member of the firefighting family. So we'll get their story in a moment. But when you first got in touch with them, I'm curious, is this something that they seemed to feel was special? Or was there any kind of like, why would you talk to us about this?
I think they are exceptionally proud that so many of their family are risking their lives on an almost daily basis. And they've been covered in some local newspapers before, and those articles were up on the wall. They were just, it just seems to be a big source of pride for them. And they're a big recruiting force. They want other people to volunteer to be firefighters. And they saw the documentary as a vehicle to maybe inspire others to do that.
I can only imagine that it's kind of a hard sell when people are out there trying to recruit volunteer firefighters. I mean, you're giving your time, you are going to be woken up in the middle of the night, you're going to possibly be risking your life, and this is all in a volunteer effort. As you talked to volunteer firefighters, not just in the Butler family, but all over the state, what were some of the common denominators? What do these people have in common?
I think it is just this will to serve their community. The motivations of what drives someone to be a firefighter is something we wanted to approach in the film, and it's a different story for each person. But I think if there is a common denominator, it's a need to provide something to help in the community, but it's whatever is in a human being that is that fire that makes, no pun intended, want someone to serve their community. I think a sense of humor, for one, that's definitely not necessary to be a firefighter, but they enjoy giving each other a hard time, all of them. And I could just go on and on with superlatives of bravery and just dignity. And I couldn't do what they do. These people are just extraordinary, just have strong characters. And each person's story is so unique, I hesitate to bundle them together and say what they're all together, except for that they treat each other like family and really have each other's backs. It's trust and loyalty and all the different things that make a family.
One of the things that really struck me as I was watching the film is just within the Butler family, there's a daughter who is a firefighter. There are daughters-in-law who are firefighters. Mm-hmm. And you also talk to other women who are volunteer firefighters around the state. As you looked at different departments around the state, is it typical to have women on the force? Is that unusual?
I don't think I interviewed with enough departments to give a good demographic sense of that, but I will say that it is something we wanted to cover in the documentary because many people just brand firefighters as men, and these women, they give just as much time on the force, and they may not be as big as one of the men, but they can still hold the fire hose, and they can still give the man hours to do that.
Were there any commonalities among the women that you talked to? I mean, there were some in the documentary that were talking about feeling discrimination when they joined the force with people when they were in training, a man saying, I'm not going to go in there with you because you can't carry me out.
Yeah, I think a commonality would be that they've all experienced that initial feeling of doubt when they joined the department, but eventually they become as big of a part of the team as anyone else. I think that's what the fact that they eventually earn their place as well as any of the men. There are probably just as many men who have the same doubts as the women do.
In the course of this documentary, the Butler family tells a number of very dramatic stories about fires that they have witnessed or been involved in. You have other firefighters talking about kind of the defining moments of their career as a firefighter, whether it's a, you know, someone killed by a drunk driver or those moments that were extremely frightening, often where they lost someone. But in a small town like Harlan, can you give us an idea of how often they get calls?
They say it changes from week to week. They could have a week where they don't hear anything from the scanner whatsoever. I mean, they can hear stuff from the scanner, but nothing they need to go out on. From a day where they get called multiple times out. The week we stayed with them, we were there maybe half an hour, and the scanner went off, and we had to go out on a call with them. And then nothing happened for the next few days, and then a little thing here or there. It's supposedly, you never know. You have to be on 100% of the time because you never know when you're going to have to go out. We slept with the scanner on because you really don't know when something can happen. I don't know how often it happens in Harlan, but I know they always are ready.
When the calls came while you were staying with the butlers, can you give me some examples of the kind of calls that they got?
They cover everything, not just fires. Traffic fender benders sometime if there are chemicals involved. We were there in the middle of the summer, so storm watching was a big thing for them. Make sure a tornado doesn't come through town, you know, just watching to know if the sirens need to go off. And there was a dumpster fire when we were there that they had to go out to, but it can be a variety of things.
Did any calls come in the middle of the night while you were there?
I don't think so, unfortunately, but we because that would have been good dramatic material for a film, but we definitely had the scanner on. We got a sense of how hard it is to sleep with one of those things going.
You probably got a little bit of a sense of what it's like to always be on call during that week. How did that feel?
Oh, it was kind of a rush because when the speaker would go off or the scanner would go off, all of a sudden you're like, oh, is that something we're gonna get to? And we had our own equipment we had to assemble, so it was kind of like, not like any heavy gear like the firefighters, but we knew we had to be ready on a minute's notice to grab the cameras and go out. But we kind of got a sense, but we weren't going to be putting our lives on the line. That was the difference.
What did you take away from the experience of really getting to know these people and spending time with them?
It really did change me profoundly in that I knew I couldn't possibly do what these people do. They sacrifice their social lives, their personal lives, in order to be on call to do this firefighting business. And it takes a very, very brave and strong person. And like I said, I found I don't know if I could do it, but if I can make a piece of art that inspires others to maybe learn more about it or is a thank you to these men and women, then that's the best I can do. But it was a life-changing experience working on this film, for sure.
Jacob, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Charity.
Jacob Rosdale is a documentary filmmaker. He was producer of the documentary Iowa's Firefighting Family. It airs tonight at 7 p.m. on Iowa Public Television. Coming up in a moment, we'll meet two members of Iowa's firefighting family, Tom and Chad Butler of Harlan. And later on this hour, we'll talk with other volunteer firefighters and EMTs from around the state. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about volunteer firefighters, and there are over 18,000 volunteer firefighters in Iowa. In a few minutes, we'll also bring a volunteer EMT, emergency medical technician, into the conversation. But first, we'll meet two members of the Butler family that has been profiled in the documentary Iowa's Firefighting Family, which airs tonight at 7 o'clock on Iowa Public Television. You can find a link to more information about the documentary on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. And with me now is Tom Butler. He's the first assistant chief of the Harlan Fire Department. He and six other members of his family serve in the Harlan Fire Department. He was the first. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And tell me how you got involved with volunteer firefighting.
It happened, oh, I don't know, 24 years ago when my wife worked at a Hy-Vee food store. The store caught on fire, and I went and actually looked at the devastation that the fire had caused. And my chief at the time was a firefighter, and he'd been prodding me to join the fire department, which I kind of resisted some, but then after seeing that, I thought, you know, that's a lot of devastation. If there's something I can do to help, I'd be glad to do it.
You mentioned your chief. What is your profession?
I sell fire equipment. I run around three states, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri, and I actually sell everything to stock a fire station.
Okay, so you are somewhat involved in this world already.
Actually, before that, I worked at a Roger, the chief now, Roger and I worked at a meat packing house. So that's how it got started there.
All right. So you were working at a meat packing house together, and he was already involved with the fire department.
He was, yes, a volunteer firefighter at that time.
Did it take a lot of convincing to get you to sign up?
Yeah, it did. It took him probably 3 months, 6 months of, you ought to join. When are you going to join? And, you know, we do this, we do that. And like I say, after seeing the devastation from the fire where my wife worked, I just decided, yeah, you know, maybe I should.
How did your family feel about it when you signed up?
My wife, she didn't know if she really liked that or not. It sure interfered a lot with our family activities. It seemed like every time my daughter had a dance recital, I was going to a fire. Or I coached little leagues when I was a firefighter, and there were times when we were in the middle of a baseball game, pager goes off, lean on my assistant coach to, you know, finish the game. Yeah, there was lots of inconveniences, being a firefighter, but when the pager goes off, you were expected to go.
Well, not only is it inconvenient, but it's also dangerous. How did she feel about that, that you were actually risking your life?
Well, you kind of phrased what you were saying about the fire. If there was times when, yeah, part of the roof was, you know, hitting you on the head, or, you know, how intense the fire was, the heat. You didn't share everything, but you gave her a picture of what was going on, because she would sit at home and worry, especially when all the kids got on.
Right, and how did that start happening? I mean, when you started, the kids were pretty little.
Yeah, they basically were raised at the fire station, every one of them. And Chad, when he turned 19, I said, are you going to join the fire department? And, of course, he was going to go to college. And he says, sure. So he went to college in Council Bluffs, so he drove back and forth. So he got on the department, and then it went to Brad, and then it went to Mike, and then Christy. When she turned 19, the boys just threw an application down in front of her and said, sign it. So, you know,
so she didn't have any choice,
She didn't have a choice. But none of my children have regretted joining the fire department.
If your son was a firefighter while he was in school, how did that even work? I mean, I can only imagine that he could get a call in the middle of a test.
No, he went to school in Council Bluffs, to college at Iowa Western.
Okay.
So we all carry a pager. So when he would get home, you know, then he could respond to a fire.
Your wife's grandmother died in a house fire in a neighboring community. Can you tell me what happened?
Grandma Emma lived by herself in a house in Portsmouth, nice big house. Took a nap, like she always does, on the couch every day. That day she had left the ceiling fan on in the bathroom, and the wiring was faulty, started the fire in the bathroom. The house was so airtight that the fire couldn't really evolve like a normal fire does. So it really smoked up the inside of the house. She just went to sleep, never woke up. I was at training in Harlan that night on the fire department and heard the page come through for Portsmouth. So my wife had called down the fire station, and they said, well, he already knows and is en route to Portsmouth. So we all met over in Portsmouth, and, you know, there wasn't anything we could do. Just a terrible tragedy.
How did that change you, to lose someone you loved in a fire?
It just makes you want to, you know, there's fire calls that we get that very good possibility somebody's inside the building or the house. Well, that trips your mind into a rescue mode, and sometimes it can harm you. Sometimes it will benefit you. But, you know, when you hear somebody's in a house and the house is on fire, it just gets you pumped up more.
In the documentary, your wife jokes that the reason she's not in the volunteer fire department is because somebody has to stay home and worry. And I can only imagine that she really must worry a lot. But you must worry, too. You're out there with your kids and yeah. and in situations where their lives are in danger and you're working alongside them. How does that affect what you do when you're at a fire?
It's not only with my kids. It is with any member of the fire department that we are responsible for setting the mode for the type of attack needed to be done, whether it's a fire or hazmat or vehicle extrication. We, as the chiefs, decide what needs to be done and inform the responding firefighters what needs to be done. Now, my kids, you know, we're together a lot. You know, we all live here in town. So whenever any or all of the kids are out in my house, that's about all we talk about is fire department stuff. We kind of know what we're thinking. My kids work very well together on any scene of a fire department function. Like I say, they grew up together. They know what they can expect from one another, and I know their strong points, their weak points, which I know most of the firefighters on my department's strong points and weak points, and you work with them.
It's pretty unusual for a family to have seven members of the family as volunteer firefighters, but it's also really unusual in small-town Iowa in this day and age to have your kids stay in town. Do you think that being firefighters together is part of what has kept them in Harlan?
Yeah, I do. That's part of it. The other part is just being a very close family. It's just that we're there for one another.
Do you ever think about the fact that the things that you're doing as a volunteer firefighter are things that in bigger cities, people get paid to do these jobs? Does that ever grate on you?
No. Yeah. No, actually it doesn't, because they're going to a job 8 to 5. They're working maybe 7 to 10 days out of the month. I like being the volunteer. You don't get anything, but a thank you. That's good enough for me.
Well, Tom, thank you. Thanks for talking to me, and thank you for all that you do.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the call.
Tom Butler is the first assistant chief of the fire department in Harlan and the head of the Butler family. He is one of seven volunteer firefighters in the family, and now his son, Chad Butler, is here. Chad is the first captain and deputy sheriff. Hello, Chad.
Hello.
You were 19 years old when you signed up with the volunteer fire department. Why did you do it?
Well, I'd seen Dad being a fireman for a few years prior to that, and when I turned 19, that was the first time I'd be eligible to try, and he asked if I wanted to, and I said yep, and so I submitted the application and got voted on a month later.
Well, your dad was telling us a little bit about how you were going to college, you were commuting, you were a volunteer firefighter. That doesn't sound like an ideal social life for a 19-year-old.
No, I would go to college during the day, and I'd come home and I'd work at night. And I was in the Iowa Army National Guard, too, at the same time, so I was pretty busy.
Wow. What made it worth it to you? You could have waited a few years. What made it worth it to you to do that then?
I think the timing was right. I was still here in Harlan, and you know, I was gone during the day, but back at night, and my job was flexible enough that if I needed to leave for a call, I could leave. And I guess the younger you start something, the sooner you learn the ins and outs of it, so...
Well, you had seen your dad doing it, but once you actually started, what was it that got you hooked?
I think just the thought of being able to help people out in their time of need, and that's kind of what got me into it and has kept me there.
Can you recall something that happened maybe in the first couple of years when you were working with the fire department that really showed you that you were making a difference?
I think the first real significant event would have been a few years after I'd been on. There was a car wreck on Highway 59 when they were redoing the roadway. A semi had stopped and a car had stopped behind it, and then another truck rear-ended the car and pushed it into the semi, and there was probably a two-year-old little boy in there that I helped to extricate and then rode all the way with to the hospital and found out later that he had a skull fracture. So I think just being with him, you know, because we were separated from his mom in a different ambulance, and just being there and trying to keep him calm was probably my first most significant time that I know that I actually helped somebody out.
Did he recover?
Yeah, he was fine.
Do you follow up with people that you help?
A lot of times it's hard to do, especially on the car accidents, because there are people traveling through. But, you know, when you have fires around the community, you're always going to see those people again. And so in that way, yeah.
Now, not only do you work with your dad in the fire department, but your brothers have joined the fire department as well, and your sister. What is it like to work with siblings? Is there any kind of competition that goes on?
Yes and no. I think in the first few years, I was busy with college and everything else, so I didn't give as much as I could have. And then when my brother Brad joined, he got full force into it, I guess you'd say, and became an instructor. And then after I saw that, he got me into being an instructor also. And so I've carried that path on ever since.
In the documentary, there's a moment where a number of you talk about an experience that you had when you were kids, where it was near the 4th of July, somebody drove past, threw a firecracker out the window, and started a grass fire in the cemetery across the street. So that was really your first firefighting experience.
Yeah, it was. We were all out in the front yard, but it was so hot and dry that summer that it ended up igniting the grass on fire, and somebody called 911 right away, and got the fire department coming, but it was a while, obviously, before they had got there, and we started grabbing buckets of water and the garden hose and everything else and tried to run across the street and put out as much of it as we could before the fire department got there.
Does that memory stick with you? Do you feel like that was when you became a firefighter in some ways?
Yeah, it probably was, actually. That's the first time I can remember ever putting a fire out that was, you know, I was right there near, so it probably sparked some of the interest in actually going on and pursuing being a firefighter.
And your sister in the documentary jokes about the fact that you forced her to join.
Yeah, it was kind of the thing she had to do when she turned 19, so.
And why was that? I mean, because I could see it just being a male thing.
I think just because she was a butler was the biggest part of it, but we did have another female on, I think two females on the department at the time. So it wasn't that macho man club anymore. We'd seen that, you know, females do belong in the fire service.
Your wife is also a firefighter. Did you encourage her to become one?
A little bit, but it really came down to one night at supper. She just said, you know, to the kids that she wanted to be a fireman. So we got her an application and she got on the department too.
Do you ever go out on calls together?
Yeah, we do quite a bit if we can. If the boys are here to watch the girls and it allows, you know, with our schedules. And yeah, we've been on quite a few calls together.
Do the kids worry about you when you go out together?
I think the boys do because they understand it more. They're a little bit older and the girls just kind of think it's pretty neat right now. They don't understand all the risks involved when we go out on calls.
How do you balance this with a job and with kids and all of the other things that go along with life?
It's challenging, that's for sure. I work nights, so I'm here during the day with the kids, and Robin works during the day, so she's here at night. And then I teach all over the state, so that kind of pulls me away a lot of weekends, but we seem to make it all work out.
You are unusual, and I mentioned this to your dad, too. You're unusual not just that you have so many people in a volunteer fire department, but also that you and your siblings have stayed in Harlan. Is this part of what's kept you in Harlan?
Yeah, it's a big part of what's kept me here.
What makes it worthwhile to you?
Just being able to give back to the community and help people out when they need it. When we get a call, it's not because they want to have us over for lunch or anything like that. It's something that's bad that's happening in their life, and they need somebody there to step in and help them out with the situation, and I guess that's what drives all of us to do it.
What does it mean to you that you are a volunteer firefighter? How does that fit into your identity?
it defines a lot of who I am, really, because so much of your time is spent with the fire department, whether it be going to calls or training or fundraising. We also do the honor guard, so we attend funerals for firefighters and ceremonies, and I guess it takes up a lot of my time, so it's definitely a part of who I am.
It's pretty easy to make a case for volunteering in general. You know, it's a great way to give back to your community and give something of yourself, make a difference in other people's lives. It seems a lot harder to make the case for voluntarily risking your life. What would you say to someone to convince them that maybe they should become a volunteer firefighter?
There's no greater honor than to give your life for another. So if that's what I'm asked to do, then that's what I'll do. I think it takes a certain kind of person to want to be a volunteer, because not everybody's going to want to do it. You can ask people and they'll say, well, I don't have time. Well, it's not about having the time to do it. It's about making the time to do it. And you have to want to make the time to do this.
Chad, thank you.
Thank you.
Chad Butler is first captain and deputy sheriff with the Harlan Fire Department. He, along with six other members of his family, are profiled in the documentary Iowa's Firefighting Family, which airs tonight on Iowa Public Television at 7. In a moment, we'll be talking to other volunteer firefighters and EMTs from around the state. We'd love to hear from you as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about volunteer firefighters. There are more than 18,000 of them in the state of Iowa. There are also many volunteer emergency medical technicians in the state. The Pella Ambulance Service, a volunteer service, is celebrating its 30th anniversary, and Doug Polking is the director of the Pella Ambulance Service. Hi, Doug.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today.
And thank you for having me.
How long have you been doing this?
I have been in EMS since late 1970s.
And what got you involved?
I was working with, or I was a volunteer fireman on a small department in rural Iowa, and there was a need for some EMTs to help staff the ambulance. So I took the class, and one thing led to a career of 30-plus years.
When somebody signs up to be an EMT, an emergency medical technician, what kind of training do they have to go through?
Well, that's the real challenge today for our volunteers. To be an EMT, licensed or certified by the state of Iowa, they have to take the EMT class, which is about 6 months of training, 120-plus hours of classroom, and another 20 to 40 hours of clinical and ride time. And its cost right now is a little over $1,000. So for the volunteer to come up and just put that right out, that is pretty tough on them at times.
So it's a tremendous commitment of both time and money from the very outset.
Absolutely. They know there's a need for their assistance in the community, and then they have to put out money and time and effort, and some of them probably haven't gone to school since they were in high school, and that may have been a few years back, and all of a sudden they're taking a college credit course. It's a tremendous effort and a tremendous commitment by their families as well. We don't want to forget their families, because they're giving up their father or husband or mother to the community. And there's a tremendous commitment by the family as well.
How many volunteer EMTs do you have in Pella?
We have 25 right now. Some of those have been with us for 30 years. Some of them have been with us for as little as 1 or 2 years. And we are in the process right now of having a class this fall again to generate some additional volunteers. It's an ongoing process that if you don't stay with it, you get in trouble immediately.
When you're on call, what are your responsibilities? What are you doing when you're waiting for that call?
Well, as volunteers, they have pagers that would sound tell them that they have to respond to the ambulance to get out and get out to the call. We have a response time of 5 minutes, so they have to be within 5 minutes of the ambulances. That's on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis. We just went through and did some mathematics of the calls that we have had and responded to, and the time commitment for the last 30 years, and we came up with some astronomical numbers as far as seconds and things like this, but the EMTs have to be within 5 minutes. They may be on calls from anywhere from, you know, an hour to 3 or 4 hours, and it happens any time of the day or night, so they have to be ready to go.
Can you remember, is there a call that you've been on that has really stood out in your memory?
There are a number of them that I can think of, good ones, bad ones, but the one I think that sticks out for me the most, and this may seem unusual, but it was a very routine transfer of a gentleman back to his home. He was in his 90s. We brought him back to his home. His wife was there. And he looked at me, and he said, thank you. And it has been one of the most significant calls I think I've ever been on, because it told me that the volunteers, the EMS, helping people, is what I really wanted to do.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for doing what you do.
Now, well, there's a lot of people out here that do it, and they deserve a lot of credit.
Doug Polking is the director of the Pella Ambulance Service, now celebrating its 30th anniversary. And now Kent Smock is with us on the line. He's a policeman in Evansdale and the volunteer fire chief. Hello, Kent.
Good morning, Charity.
And as a policeman, you clearly already had made a commitment to service. When did you get involved in firefighting, too?
I started with the fire service in 1976, the same year that I started in law enforcement.
And why did you do that?
I've always been brought up as with the sense of community, of being able to help and give. I'm a second generation. My father was on the fire department, as well as the police department, so it just became very natural for me to move into that field as well.
How many volunteers do you have in Evansdale?
Currently we're at 27. We've been as high as 39, and we've been considerably lower at one time. So we're always looking for good recruits to come on to put on to help give back to their community.
Can you give me an idea of how many calls you have to field in a week or a month?
We average not quite 2 calls a day. We are just between 650 and 700 calls a year.
Evansdale is quite close to Waterloo. If you were to have a big fire or something where you needed more assistance, do you get support from Waterloo?
Oh, absolutely. We can get it for Waterloo as well as the other volunteer departments that are close by to us, Raymond and Gilbertville. We have standing agreements that's called a mutual aid agreement, that any time we need help or that they need help, all we have to do is ask, and they'll send their resources to us.
When you try to recruit people to be a part of your volunteer fire service, what do you tell them?
First, we talk with them about what their commitment is going to be, because it does take a lot to be on a volunteer service in the way of training, in the way of time and commitment. There are going to be times when you're going to miss out on family events because of the obligation you'd have. But we also want to explain to them the feeling of self-fulfillment that they'll get, of gratitude that they're giving back to their community, as well as just being able to help their neighbor. And that's the way we look at it, is these are our neighbors at a time when they are probably at their most vulnerable and need us the most.
Is there a story that you share from your own personal experience that really drove that home for you?
Oh, there are several from times when we have been involved in life-saving, where people, our actions have actually played a part and a role in saving someone's life.
Can you tell me about one that kind of stands out?
Probably the first one, back when defibrillators were first being put on ambulances. We had a fundraiser and were able to put one defibrillator on one of our two ambulances. And the first call that defibrillator was on that call or on that ambulance for, we went to the house. It was a woman who had actually collapsed from another issue. Her husband, through the anxiety, suffered a heart attack and his heart stopped. We were able to apply the defibrillator to him, delivered a shock. We restored a heartbeat, transported him to the hospital, and he made a full recovery and lived several more years afterward. And that just kind of reinforced what we were doing and why we were doing it, that all of our hard work, our efforts of fundraising and training had really paid off because we saw the life saved.
You invest so many hours in this, and all volunteer firefighters, EMTs do, and we were just talking with Doug Polking about how to become an EMT, they need to invest $1,000 right at the beginning to pay for all of the training and courses. Governor Branstad has introduced a $50 tax credit that's going to begin in 2013 for volunteer firefighters and EMTs. What was your response when you heard about that?
I was happy to see that they were recognizing firefighters and volunteer EMTs. It's not a huge benefit to us, monetarily, but at least they're acknowledging that Iowa, being a rural state, is pretty well protected by volunteers throughout all of our rural areas. So just that acknowledgement and the recognition that the state has made, when you look at the number of volunteers that are out there, both fire and EMS, you multiply that times the $50, we're talking into that $1 million range that's going to come out of the state budget. That in and of itself is significant. And we're hoping that, in the future they can expand upon that. But it brings to a point the recognition and the need for some incentives to keep people involved in the volunteer fire and EMS and volunteering for all aspects of public service.
Well, Kent, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Kent Smock is a policeman in Evansdale. He is also the volunteer fire chief in Evansdale. And finally with us today is Bill Horning. He is the assistant fire chief in Coralville. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
And Coralville is kind of a hybrid organization. You have a few paid employees. The rest are volunteers. Can you tell me a little bit about the structure?
That's correct. We call it a combination department. We are a little bit different than most volunteer departments who are strictly volunteer by association, and they usually have the trustees of that township will organize and pay for a fire department, or actually fundraise for them or ask them to protect their community. Our city is actually a city to fire department, so we have a paid chief of about 10 years. We have a fire prevention officer who is paid. He's been on about 8 years. We have a training officer who's obviously his full-time job is to train all the volunteers. And then we have an equipment officer who we just brought on within the last 6-9 months as a new addition to try to keep some of the administrative duties taken care of to free up the volunteers' time.
Coralville has over 18,000 people, almost 19,000 people, maybe more by now. That seems like a pretty big town to have a volunteer fire department. Is that unusual?
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you look at Boone County, Missouri, they have a department of over 200 volunteers with 13 or 14 paid staff that services a much larger community than we do, and they're able to maintain a volunteer department. Several communities throughout the nation, are able to maintain a volunteer department. It just really depends on what your city's willing to pay for, what what your resources are to be able to recruit people. Obviously, smaller communities have a harder time recruiting people because they don't have the resources. Here at Coralville, we have the University of Iowa, so we have a big influx of people. It's a pretty booming area, so we're able to maintain a good recruiting effort and keep volunteers running the department.
How many volunteers do you have?
We fluctuate between 45 and 55 volunteers pretty routinely.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is.
So when you're on call, we've talked about this a little bit, do you have a pager? Is that how your system works?
That's correct. Everyone on the department carries a pager, and we ask them to make themselves available whenever they can, 7x24x365.
When everybody is carrying around a pager, you're not hanging out in a firehouse waiting for the call. How do you build a team when you're all apart?
Are you asking how we build a team after a response is asked for and we have to meet up and do that?
No, just how do you build the team atmosphere and know that you can work well together, given that you're not in contact with each other all the time?
I understand. Okay, well, for our department, we require that each of the members attend a monthly training. So we have a 2 to 2.5 hour training session every month. All members are required. If they do not participate in that training, they need to make it up. If they do not make it up, they lose their accountability tags and are no longer allowed to respond to calls. So we highly encourage them to attend the department training, which allows us to work together as a team. We typically split up and do company-based 6 to 8 people doing different evolutions, and we rotate the people around within those groups and also rotate, obviously, the different training evolutions that they do. Obviously, throughout the year, we have multiple events, so open houses, the Fire Prevention Week with all the schools. We do a lot of tours for daycares and other organizations like to come and tour the department, and we pull people in and change those people that do those tours. We encourage our people when they're out training. We have do pre-plans, so we send them out doing pre-plans. Our departments have recreation areas, so we have like a ping pong table, we have video games and that type of activity, we have a weight room. Both stations are open to the members to use at any time. A lot of the college students who are members come down and do their, you know, when they're not in class, come down and do their studying and training at the fire department. And we try to keep it a very open door, friendly atmosphere where we all can see each other and participate with each other as much as possible.
Have you been out to the landfill fire in Iowa City?
We have not been invited to that, no.
There is an annual memorial service that takes place every year in Coralville at the Iowa Firefighters Memorial. It's coming up next Sunday. Have you participated in that?
I have participated in that since it was established, yes.
What does that mean to you?
I think it's a wonderful and a privilege for Coralville to house the memorial service. It's a really nice property. We've spent a lot of time as a fire department up there making sure that that land is in very good, presentable condition. You know, we're constantly trying to upgrade it and make it nice. Obviously, there's no greater sacrifice in our eyes than someone who gives their life in the line of duty, and we're honored to recognize those that have given years of service to the service, that they can get their name put on the wall as recognition for the service that they gave. I mean, it's a very emotional and makes you proud. You know, you're sad and proud all at the same time. It's good to get together with people and share events.
Well, Bill, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Bill Horning is the Assistant Fire Chief in Coralville. And again, the documentary Iowa's Firefighting Family airs tonight at 7 o'clock on Iowa Public Television. You can find out more information on our website and on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about honeybees and beekeeping. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.